Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 191.
This week on the podcast, Sunday's Democratic debate reminds us of all the terrible things that snuck through in the 90s while America was transfixed by the Spice Girls.
The super moniker is now available to any day with between 3 and 1 million primaries. Welcome to Super Sunday. Enjoy Super Monday.
A sad day for the Reagan family answers the ever-present query, is Nancy Reagan still alive?
And CPAC welcomes the failed aristocratic rights activist Mitt Romney to deliver a highly dubious rebuke of the tacky rich.
Plus, an anti-Trump shadow attack pack is finally getting some airtime.
And Donald Trump promises worried Americans that the documented stubbiness of his fingers isn't a euphemism.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com. Welcome to a special bi-coastal edition of the podcast.
That's right. Someday I want to do a bi-coastal edition where I'm in New York and you're in Los Angeles.
I know, we've never gotten to do that one, have we?
I know.
I feel like the problem is you're not traveling enough. You gotta.
I'm not traveling.
You gotta commit.
At all.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate and upsetting.
Traveling is how you get to be on a different coast than someone else. You got to go there.
That's true.
You got to get to that.
You got to leave.
Yeah. Anyway, we should just dive in because,
Let's do it.
I can't even, like.
There's so much.
Every week it's like more things happen and they're
I know,
it's more
I keep
great
thinking
than the last
that we've
week.
Hit like peak.
Week?
Whatever.
Peak news.
Peak week. Peak, yeah.
I know.
And we just haven't.
I'm worried we're never going to get there.
If next week somehow manages to be better than this week, I feel like I might just have to call quits.
I know. I don't even know at a certain point how we're going to get through all of the news that we have to report. We've basically pared it down to almost exclusively election news at this point.
We're only talking about presidential politics this week.
I mean,
basically.
That's how we
because
like things
else?
To be. But
we could have been like actively in World War III and we wouldn't have had time to speak about it tonight.
No, I know. We could have bombed 3/4 of the world this week and not found out about it even because it would have been had to be on like page 3 of the newspaper.
That's right.
Because much has been going on.
Right, because we were busy talking about Donald Trump's penis all week.
Exactly.
So we're
fresh off of the Democratic debate that happened in Flint tonight.
That's right.
We just watched that. We haven't really had time.
We delayed doing the podcast for you, dear listeners.
That's right, because
Lila
we care
is up
that
very
much.
Late on the East Coast right now.
That's right.
And it's all because we wanted to watch this debate for you.
That's right. And we haven't really had time to put together our thoughts on it. But we're just going to run through some highlights that we thought were highlights. We don't know what the highlights, according to the news cycle, are going to be because that news cycle hasn't happened yet.
I don't give a single damn what they think
we
the
are the news cycle. The news cycle is just a lot of people talking about how Hillary Clinton is an inevitable winner. So I can't with the news cycle right now anyway.
Oh, and trust us, we're going to get to that in a little bit.
So true. But so in any case, this was an interesting debate because it began, I felt like, on a really strong note because they were talking about water issues in Flint and infrastructure issues in general, especially in parts of Michigan like Detroit and Flint that have been, you know, featuring huge losses in terms of jobs and, you know, other, like just the economy in general in a lot of Michigan has fallen apart because the auto industry has moved abroad and, you know, these were part of the sort of Rust Belt economy. So it started off on a strong note. It ended on a question about what Hillary Clinton prays for at night. So I don't know that it necessarily went in a, I don't know that it necessarily was on an upward trajectory. Exactly.
Right. I knew that you were hating that, but like, I was shocked at that, actually, because, like, I mean, you know, Bernie does a pretty good job on faith, considering that I'm
pretty he's
convinced that he doesn't have any.
Right.
But she often does, too, and I know that you wouldn't necessarily approve of the answers that she gives, but I feel like oftentimes, like, for Christians, I feel like she answers that question pretty well. I mean, she has been a lifelong Methodist, so I often sort of can relate to
and you can probably recognize the language that she's using as well to talk about religion.
And she often quotes John Wesley, who started Methodism. And,
right.
You know, I mean, like,
I've never heard of.
But she, exactly. But she, I really felt like, you know, she didn't do terrible on that question, but like, it was the last one of the night, and she was like the person to get it. It was like before their closing statements.
Well, and it was a gimme question.
You could hear a pin. It was a gimme question. You could hear a pin drop in the room, and I feel like she really sort of flubbed it. I mean, she didn't flub it in a way that was like...
The woman who asked it, she had been to that woman's church. She referenced that they had been to church together.
Yes.
So it was not just a gimme question. It was like a setup question. And she still didn't do that well on it.
Right. She just really didn't get to it. And I'm not exactly totally convinced I know why. Because she's usually better on that.
I know why. It was because, as I was telling you via text... They set up this question to make Bernie Sanders look like a person without faith, and he threw the Holocaust at them. And then Hillary Clinton had to one-up him somehow with a question about her own religion and couldn't.
And because you know what? You can't.
You can't. He had just talked about how his family had actually come to America escaping the Holocaust and that he very much understood the dangers of extremism, and he very much understood how important it is that we all care about each other as much as we care about our own families. And then she had to go in and be like, well... I once thought about.
I pray for people who I know by name.
Exactly.
Is how she started that question, by the way.
I know.
Which is like, I pray for my well-off friends.
Yes.
Like
you, I have friends that enjoy my prayers, like the head of Goldman Sachs, a close personal friend of mine who I pray for every night. Like, it just, there was no way, like, they had thought that was supposed to be a setup for her. And there was no way to one-up his answer because he was supposed, you know, he was giving an answer where he was going to have to admit somewhere along the line that he doesn't really talk about faith. And they even asked him specifically about it. And he was like, no, I'm Jewish. I'm proud to be Jewish. And I very much understand the dangers of us, you know, falling for the kind of rhetoric we're seeing on the other side because my family escaped that. And then she had to be like, oh, here's who I pray for it. And I, like, that's not, there's no way to win that. Yeah. She got him, she did pretty, you know, she kept trying to draw the conversation back to his votes on guns because she, you know, that's kind of one of her winning talking points. But the problem was, I think that came too early in the debate. So they kind of clashed on that for a little while. And then, but that conversation ended up oddly being about whether they think manufacturers should be held responsible for gun deaths or gun violence. And that was kind of a weird direction for that question to go in.
Well, that has always been where she sort of like tries to attack him on guns. I mean, there's the Brady Bill.
Right. That's the Brady Bill vote.
But there's this other bill that had a lot of things in it, as he likes to point out. But one of the things is whether they would. Yeah, whether gun manufacturers would be responsible for gun deaths. And I said to you, I'm like, as a person who, you know, if you've read our gun blog, if you haven't, you should. But, you know, we have sort of stated that we're in favor of
all guns being taken away from
all
people.
All of the guns going away. And as a person who can say that I want, you know, the government to come into your home and take your guns from you, I still don't give a single damn about this whole gun manufacturing being, you know, gun manufacturers being responsible for gun deaths.
Like,
I get it, certainly.
Sure,
I'm not, you know, about it, but like, it's just not a thing. I mean,
it's not the talking point I'm looking to hear about this. I don't care about guns getting safer because the issue is not that, I mean, there is an issue of children accidentally firing weapons and other people accidentally firing weapons. There is a bigger issue of, you know, angry white men going and shooting up places who know how to use the guns safely but are choosing not to. And so that, like, the answer about, like, that's something that I see why that's important, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I just also don't think that's not the answer that I want to hear to this issue at all. So I don't really care about the discussion about it. Right. So I basically tune out every time that I hear someone talk about it.
It's not the smoking gun that she wishes it work.
No, but then
do you see what I did there?
That was a great pun, Brent. Good job.
Thank you.
But also later in the conversation, they talked about fracking specifically, and that was one of the last issues they discussed. And he got her good on that because she is in favor of fracking. And as much as she tried to talk around the issue and talk about all the conditions she would impose on fracking, he was able to stand up and be like, "I'm against fracking. There is not a safe way to do fracking. It is wrong." And I am on the Environmental Regulation Committee.
Her answer on fracking was, for me, one of the seminal moments of the evening.
I know.
Because
it was too ridiculous.
It was so bonkers. It was the most meandering thing. Like, it was like, well, if the state doesn't want to do it and they haven't met 74 conditions that we place on them, then, then they can do it if they want, but shouldn't if they don't. It was like, it literally didn't make any sense. It was wacko. And then, of course, they came to Sanders next, and he was like, my answer is much shorter.
Right.
No, I don't support fracking. Because she literally gave the most convolutedly ridiculous answer that I've ever heard.
Well, because she gets energy,
maybe
industry
ever,
money.
At a debate.
This is like, she can't be against fracking because she gets money from the very industry that wants it. So she has, like, there are these issues where the reason that she has to give really specific policy suggestions, because there were times where I was like, it's kind of frustrating that he's giving these vague think big answers and she's going like, well, what we should do is reinstate this act that we did in 1994 where we blah, blah, blah. But it was because a lot of the time she can't give broad answers because she has to be against everything for the money. So she can't, you know, she can't be like, no, I'm against fracking. It's a bad idea. We'll figure out how to stop it. She has to be like, here are 74 reasons that I would make sure fracking is more difficult to do than it is right now, because she can't say no.
Right.
It's, you know, and at times I don't think that plays well for him, but at other times, such as in this conversation about fracking, it plays really poorly for her because it makes her sound like she's not answering the question. And she really
lost that fracking
conversation. Lost that fracking conversation, and it was very late in the conversation. And anyway, as my dad has been saying, it feels like she's running to be America's middle manager. It's like she's trying to MBA us all into voting for her. Like she
totally.
She has a lot of really specific policy suggestions that are meant to obscure the larger point. And so, you know, she has a lot of ways in which she doesn't really talk about our goals as much as she talks about, well, we could install 3 people at the EPA who could do blah, blah, blah. And that's all to talk around the larger conversation that she can't have because of the money.
Right. Well, and that was the whole thing, that she did the same thing when they were talking about infrastructure spending, where they asked her, you know, you have proposed $250 billion in infrastructure spending, and Senator Sanders has proposed $1 trillion. And she was like, well, I want, you know, a certain amount of it to be passed by Congress, and then I want to start the bank, which will have $25 billion in it and will increase tenfold over the next. And it's sort of like,
it's like, I don't understand
what
you're talking
about. Is that she, what she's explaining to you is why she only has a quarter of the spending.
Exactly.
And you're still only left with a quarter of the spending.
Right. There's like, you can't outmath math. Math is still math.
You can't. That's right.
I mean, these are.
She did that a few times in the evening. I feel like she sort of did something similar when they were talking about education and like, how, I mean, I feel like she often gets into sort of, well, and even Anderson Cooper at one point was like, let me tell you what this is, like, if you're not as wonkish as we all are on stage. I think when they were talking about the XM Bank or something like that.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I think that they get a little, she gets a little more granular than I think that like people are looking for in
a debate. But she has to, because she can't talk about the broader issue. There was.
Right. She can't give a straight
answer. She can't give a straight answer. So she's got to get granular. There was one conversation that I was kind of frustrated with Bernie on, not because I don't agree with him on it, but because I felt like he didn't say the thing that I wanted to hear him say. And that was the conversation about bailing out the auto industry. He was talking about, he voted against the bailout. He kept bringing it back to saying, listen, I don't think that the middle class should be forced to pay for the mistakes of these Wall Street executives. But he didn't ever connect that line of reasoning directly to the auto industry and say, I'm in favor of supporting programs that would have helped the people impacted by this. But I did not think it was fair to bail out, you know, businesses that had run into the ground because they had, you know, because they had not been practicing their business responsibly.
Yeah.
Like that you know, he sort of made that connection to Wall Street. He never made that connection with the auto industry. And I wanted to hear him say that because it felt like he was not talking about, it felt like he was sort of obscuring his point on that answer. And his point, his belief at least, is that the little guy shouldn't have to bail out the big guy, that we should do what we can to support the little guy when the big guy fucks up. But what it sounded like he was saying was that I'm not going to try not to say anything. I'm going to try not to say the word auto industry and see what happens.
Well, and I also think that he could have, again, tied what was going on with the auto industry at the time back to all of the trade agreements. And I don't think that he did that.
He did talk a lot about the trade agreements, but he didn't connect it as well as he could have.
He didn't do it in that answer that you're talking specifically about. And there was an opportunity to do so because we wouldn't have needed to have had that bailout, or at least not to the degree that we ended up having to have it.
Right, if all of those places hadn't been moving their facilities elsewhere and crashing the economy of places like Detroit and Flint.
Correct. And he did say that at a certain point later in the debate, but it wasn't in a sort of cohesive response to what you're talking
about. Although, can we talk about how exciting it was that the crowd really seemed legitimately into him? This is the first time that we've seen a debate crowd at a Democratic debate that has, I mean, there have been times that he's gotten huge applause lines over things that Hillary Clinton doesn't agree with. but they've been mostly party insiders that have been in the audiences of these debates. This was really the first time that we saw a debate crowd that was like pretty jazzed to have him there. Like they seemed pretty excited to see him. So that was kind of exciting.
And that's good because he really, you know, he needs to do well on Tuesday. Yeah. I mean, it's not as if he's going to drop out if he gets blown out, but he really shouldn't get blown out. And this state is good for him. I mean, yes, it has a large African-American population, which he's been winning a lot, but it also has a huge white, you know, blue collar sort of rust belty, you know, working class. And
this conversation that sort of sets him up to be someone who can never win the black vote is a false comparison. Right. Anyway,
he gave a really good answer in regards to that tonight. Yeah. As well.
I don't think that that's the narrative that's actually been happening here. The Clintons have very deep roots in the South. So, of course, they were able to use their organization really effectively in the South. And the South just happens to be the only states that have any African-American voters that have voted so far. It is not as if there are no African-American voters who, once they know Bernie Sanders, couldn't vote for him. That's a crazy, but because, you know, the media has sort of been pushing that as if there is some sort of reason that black voters can't vote for Bernie Sanders. And the reason is really just that they are familiar with Hillary Clinton and they're not familiar with Bernie Sanders. And that has a lot to do with the fact that people in the South aren't familiar with Bernie Sanders because he's from Vermont. But it's not as if he's not representing, you know, ideologies or his platform somehow is like terrible for African American voters. It's really an issue of familiarity and name recognition and a lot of you know, and the sort of deep history that the Clintons have in the South. It's not this sort of narrative that's been set up where there's this implication that like black voters will never vote for Bernie Sanders. That's
right.
That's crazy. That's not it.
Agreed. No, it's not. You're right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely
I've been getting frustrated by that because I feel like so, you know, that has become a really dominant theme in the way that we've discussed primary results. And as much as I understand that it is and should be concerning for his campaign that there are these huge disparities when it comes to African-American voters, obviously he should aim to want, you know, to have African-American voters feel like he's representing them well as well. And that you know, that's something that I think his campaign is working towards. But it's not... The African-American voters are not casting a vote against Bernie Sanders. They are casting a vote for a familiar candidate in parts of the country where she has been part of the fabric of their political life for, you know, since the 80s.
Decades.
For decades. Like, since the 80s, basically. Like, this is not some sort of grand rebuke of Sanders' policies. In any case, that's something that has nothing to do with the debate that I just felt like saying. Let's talk for a moment about how Nancy Reagan died today. Because
she did.
She did. So if you, we have asked several times on this podcast if she's still alive. And
we didn't know. What do you want from us?
A lot of people didn't know the answer to this. Now we all know the answer as a society. She was 94. She had had some health problems recently and she still looked pretty great. I don't like Nancy Reagan is someone who I think one of the reasons I never knew if she was alive or not was because I always felt like she looked young enough that that could have been the last picture of her. she was an actress, you know, she was very stylish. She was working, she was an actress by the name Nancy Davis when she met Ronald. And then basically became the president when his brain started to go and she had to be the person running the country.
The first woman president.
The first Nancy woman president, Reagan. Nancy Reagan. She also invented, she was a big part of the drug war. She basically invented Just Say No.
She did, yeah.
And she was a big, she was, a, after Reagan died, she was a big advocate for stem cell research. So she actually went head to head with the Republican Party a bunch.
Yeah, that that put her at odds with specifically George W. Bush after.
But there were some hilarious, some hilarious revelations in various obituaries that we read that had to do with how she wielded her power when she was in the White House. And One of the things that we read is there was this tell-all published by a former chief of staff, Donald Regan, in 1988, where he revealed that Nancy had started to consult an astrologer after Ronald Reagan was shot in 1981. And then, like, years later, she started, like, when she was basically running the country, she would require all of the major decisions regarding the president's schedule to be run past this fortune teller in San Francisco. this guy who wrote this book was not the hugest fan of her. He also basically painted her as like this vindictive person who got him fired for disagreeing with her. So that's, you know, that's that. She couldn't be too terrible because Ron Reagan's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very
he's
true.
He's an atheist.
Yeah.
He's a Democrat. He's a dancer. He was with the Joffrey Ballet for a while. So
I didn't know that.
I feel like Ron Reagan turned out to be he's not they're not like the Bush family where everyone after Ronald Reagan turned out to be a dipshit. They
right.
They
right.
They accidentally bred someone cool. So that's nice. I think it's because they had these roots in Hollywood. So all of the kids went back to like go do various, you know, Hollywood-y stuff because they were from LA, you know. So it wasn't like, in any case, rest in peace, Nancy Reagan. But 94, good long life. I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about her in the coming years and hopefully some exciting revelations about her role as the president of the United States when Ronald Reagan was losing his marbles.
That's right.
So in any case, this week was big because not only did we have Super Tuesday, but we had a fake holiday, Super Saturday, which was what we were calling yesterday because there were three primaries.
I can't with that. That was just ridiculous. Too dumb.
Too dumb.
Come on.
We can't call every day that has primaries Super something. There's only 7 days.
Super Saturday has more of a ring than Super Tuesday does.
Super Tuesday.
Like, also, like if you're going to call Super Tuesday Super Tuesday,
then you have to think of a new.
You can't call Super Saturday. It has to be something different.
Also, because it's just it can't be a holiday because Super Tuesday was super because there were like 13 primaries. Saturday only had 3. That's not super at all. You can't call that super if your if the qualification for being super is 13 primaries.
Agreed.
That's some bullshit.
I'm with you.
In any case, thanks CNN. We're going to start with the Democratic results. We are still annoyed that everybody seems to be reporting the delegate totals with superdelegates included because, we've stated 1 trillion times, that's completely inappropriate. They are not pledged. They will decide when they decide who to vote for, and that can happen as late as the day of. So
yes, like, tell us who is winning the contests that have been voted on by the people who have voted in them.
Yeah,
like,
well, the
that
other thing, I feel like they could be polling superdelegates. There could be superdelegate polls going on, and that could be something that we consider going into the convention. But I can't abide by the system whereby the superdelegates are already counted towards the total. They are basically the last primary. So let's treat them like a primary. They don't vote until the day of the convention, so let's not treat it like they've already voted. In any case, here's how the wins and losses broke down. On Tuesday, Bernie won Colorado, Minnesota, Oklahoma, and Vermont, and Hillary won Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Massachusetts, Tennessee, Texas, and Virginia. Some caveats to that, one being that Massachusetts was essentially a tie. It was 50-49. So
only one delegate differential, I believe, right?
Exactly. It was a one delegate differential. That's something that we have talked about how that was kind of a must-win for Bernie, but we feel pretty good about the results there because it was like an Iowa win. It was too close to really be considered a definitive win. And then another thing that kept getting discussed was that Virginia Virginia is a huge swing state. Hillary won Virginia. I just wanted to mention that Virginia is also, the Democratic constituency in Virginia is largely influenced by DC because many of them live right outside of Washington. You know, when we wait on election night to find out the Virginia results, we're always waiting for a really long time to get the Arlington results because their polls close later. And that's where most of the population of Virginia lives. So that's just a caveat to that. I don't know if you can hear this siren going by me, but
I can actually.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Yeah. This is the soundtrack of New York City. It's really it's going for it. They're not kidding.
You're getting a treat tonight on the podcast.
Think about all the sirens you're going to get to hear. In any case, so Super Tuesday was interesting because they really weren't able to go with the narrative that they usually go with, or that they were planning to go with, which was that Hillary Clinton was now unbeatable and Bernie was out. Because he won every state besides Massachusetts that he was thinking he maybe could have a chance in, and some of those are swing states, and some of those were surprising wins.
Right. Well, and what I think he should be doing here, and she sort of did the same thing in 2008, and it really annoyed me at the time, but when you look at the places that they are both winning, he is winning in the places that are a little more sort of swingy than she is. Because he won in Colorado and Minnesota, which are swing states.
Right.
And he had already won in New Hampshire, which is a swing state. Iowa was basically a tie, which is a swing state. She won in Alabama. We're going to lose that regardless. Arkansas will lose that. Georgia will lose that. Massachusetts, any unnamed Democrat will win.
Right.
So, like, whatever. Plus, that was a tie. Tennessee, we're going to lose. Texas, we're going to lose. And then Virginia, which I guess is a swing state. But, I mean, I think that he can make the point that he is winning, and by pretty sizable margins, in the places that we are going to need to win right. in the fall.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, every time that we have one of these super days, he wins just enough states that he really can't be counted out. So
correct.
Saturday came yes. along. He won Nebraska and Kansas. She won Louisiana. They ended up with similar delegate counts coming out of that day. Today, right. he just won the Maine caucus by a pretty big margin, too, by a 2-1 margin.
2-1.
So that was a pretty big win. So the delegate totals, as they stand without the unpledged delegates, are he has 475 and she has 673. That's a large-ish gap, but it's a smaller. I mean, the state of California has 500 and something delegates. So right. these delegate count. This is not a gap that's unclosable for him, especially because yeah. you know the southern states. The margins were not close. She won those states handily. Some of them she had like a 70-point margin in. But the South is almost done voting, so the map might shift a little bit. The southern states were definite wins for Hillary always. Yeah. But yeah. the map's going to start looking better as we get into the Rust Belt because a lot of his platform is going to appeal to some of these Rust Belt states. You know, we saw this audience in Michigan be very, you know, get very excited about some of his proposals. And
yeah.
and I think that we're going to, you know, as the sort of familiarity with him and the idea that you can vote for him starts to spread, we might see some surprises in some of these states. So, you know, Clinton is looking at a few must wins in the coming days because she wants to sort of wrap this thing up by March 15th. But obviously, he's not going right. to leave the race, so it sort of doesn't matter.
No.
They're correct. Kind of talking like now, the firewall is if right. you know she wants to win Florida, Ohio, Illinois, North Carolina, Missouri. She wants to win Michigan on the 8th. I don't think it's worth thinking of this way because Sanders isn't going to leave, but that's her prerogative. No.
He probably, I agree with you that he isn't going to leave, but there is... Let's face it, and, you know, I don't like facing reality sometimes.
No,
who
terrible.
Does? Reality is terrible sometimes. But there is a real chance that she could win all of this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And if that is the case, then it probably becomes to the point where it's borderline, considering also just the momentum that she's going to have, impossible for him to get the nomination. But I agree with you. It doesn't, there's no reason for him to get out. I think her having to continue to debate him is good for her, and I think she would probably say that,
yeah.
actually.
No, I agree.
And there's no reason why he's going to continue to have money. People are going to continue to give him money. He made $40-some million just
in
the month of February. He made that last day of February, or on Super Tuesday or whatever, he made like $6 million, which was more than Marco Rubio made last month.
Yeah. No,
period.
Well, and also...
In one day.
I love... So he said he's had 5 million donations, and he's made, you know, he made $40 million or 40-some-odd million dollars last month. Hillary Clinton at the debate was like, well, I've had 800,000 donations of under $100.
Right.
And it was like, okay, don't use this talking point at all. Just don't say it.
No.
Just say nothing.
Yeah. So I agree with you. He's not going to drop out, and he absolutely shouldn't. He should take all of the delegates that he can to the convention, and he should
try to
do whatever he can with them.
Well, he should try to make sure that some of his ideas end up in the platform, because that's what we have the ability to do here. That, you know, I've been talking about this. My mother has been talking about this a lot as she talks to some voters her own age who have been sort of critical of the Sanders movement because they think it's just a bunch of, you know, optimistic kids who don't know what's what. And she's been saying, listen, we're all progressives here. If these issues that he's talking about resonate with you, you don't have to care if he becomes the president or not. But if you vote for him, these issues end up at the convention. And then when we talk about
right.
what our platform is as a party, we get to talk about these issues. We can say, is
right.
single payer on the table? Yes, 80% of voters are in favor of it. Whereas if he doesn't go to the convention and he just sort of throws in the towel before that, then we don't have that leverage. So we're sort of having a larger... you know, discussion within the Democratic Party than just the presidency, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
So, in any case, vote for Bernie Sanders, guys.
Yeah. That's right.
But, in any case, there's also been some interesting chatter about who Clinton would rather run against, because one of the things that, you know, as we were about to talk about, there have been some interesting results in the Republican primaries,
right.
and Trump and Cruz both seem to have some momentum at this point. Trump with more momentum, but Cruz seems to be the only other person with momentum. So Clinton has sort of said that she's happy to run against Trump. She thinks she can defeat him. A lot of people with, you know, a lot of Democratic operatives have sort of worried that Trump's sort of randomness will be threatening
right.
to her because she's very kind of rigid in certain respects. And the fact that he doesn't obey any of the sort of like, and he doesn't obey any of the sort of like social etiquette or just political etiquette of the presidential race will be kind of jarring for her. Like, she'll have a difficult time adjusting to that. And I tend to agree that that might not be the greatest for her. But interestingly, they were saying that her, this is according to Politico, because they're a bunch of gossip mongers over there. They were saying that her camp's preferred adversary would be Cruz, because everything that he said, he's so extreme, but he plays by the rules. And so Clinton would sort of know how to outmaneuver him.
Right. I do think, though, that the more I think about it, though, I think Trump gives her a better opportunity to sort of recreate the, you know, millennials aside, which she needs to work on, the you know, what everybody likes to call the Obama coalition. Yeah. Because if you think that the Clinton camp doesn't have an ad already ready to go with him talking about, you know, with him not rebuking David Duke and the KKK and all of the things that he has said about immigrants to this country, and all of the things that he has said about Muslims, and all of the things that he has said about women, I think that he gives her a better opportunity to really run up the score with those groups.
Yes.
That maybe a Ted Cruz doesn't quite give her the same opportunity. I mean, obviously, it's not as if like a large, you know, it's not as if Ted Cruz is going to get a bunch of black people to vote for him. Like, let's not kid ourselves. Right. But I mean, he also sort of like hasn't gone down the extreme sort of, you know, roads that Donald Trump has in those respects in the way that would allow her to sort of really like basically have 100% of that group of people vote for
her. Well, I worry. I mean, I think on the one hand, that's true. I hate to like plan for an election where the majority of the electorate is voting against someone instead of for someone.
I agree with
That's so frustrating.
I agree.
But I mean, I agree that that would sort of be the reality. I think the one thing that she would have to worry about with, you know, with Trump is that he's kind of been a chameleon. He doesn't say anything real. So he can sort of chameleonize his way into, you know, into a lot of different people's minds. It's because it's been confusing to watch all these people, him say all this ridiculous nonsense and then have all these people support him. But I sort of can sense, I can sort of see what it is that he's doing to appeal to those people and where he chooses to kind of ramp up the fear rhetoric and where he doesn't. And he's been really clever about that. I don't think intentionally, but just by sheer intuition.
Right. Accidentally.
Cleverness. And I think that it would be difficult for her to get a grasp on how to attack him because the attacks lay themselves out so neatly on her side. We already know what the attacks are going to be against her, and they're stupid and they're old and we shouldn't care about them anymore. I don't care about Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, and that will absolutely be on the table if Donald Trump is running for president, which is ridiculous.
Of course.
And like, I don't care about the Benghazi emails, but that will absolutely be on the table. And there, you know, there are so many like, you know, GOP spook theories that are going to come out of the woodwork again with Trump. But I don't know that she can predict where he goes with his own campaign.
That's true.
Like Cruz, you know exactly where he's going to go because he's never changed his mind about a single thing in his entire life because he's committed to being an asshole. He's not stopping anywhere along. He's not stopping anywhere on the way toward being an asshole. He's there and he's staying. But I think that she would have a difficult time sort of, you know, dealing with Donald Trump because he's a misogynistic prick. He would not be respectful of her at the debates. She's used to everyone being respectful of her, even as they launch pseudo-sexist attacks on her. Like, there would be all of these things that would be so outside of her comfort zone that, you know, that she has to know we're coming because she knows him. She's been to his wedding.
Right.
I mean, you know, she knows Donald Trump. But, like, so she has to know he's kind of a wild card. So, like, I don't know. I think it would be an interesting election to watch, and I would be frustrated by it once again, all of us having to vote against an evil instead of for a good. But I sort of see why people in her circle are a little irked by the prospect of a Trump election, because they already don't understand what's happening in this election, and he is the symbol of what doesn't make any sense. Like,
yeah, totally.
Anyway, let's talk about the GOP results, because they're funny.
Let's do that. They're fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's been an
Donald
odd week,
Trump,
you guys.
Totally. Donald Trump on Tuesday won Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Massachusetts, which I learned how to spell.
Finally,
this week,
Brent knows
guys.
How to spell.
I apparently
that, so
didn't learn
fine.
How to say it because I just had to say it like three times. Tennessee, Vermont, Virginia.
Right.
And on Saturday, he won Kentucky and Louisiana.
He's up to 382 delegates. He's in the lead sorry, by 82. What was interesting about watching this week it happen was that on Tuesday, he almost swept. Cruz won Alaska, Oklahoma, and Texas. We knew he was going to win Texas. Right. Oklahoma was a little bit of a surprise. Alaska's an irrelevant state that no one cares about. I mean, I guess Alaskans care about it. I don't know. But maybe. But so the and Rubio only won Minnesota. He got second in Virginia and a distant second in Massachusetts, but otherwise was third everywhere. So I feel like the major story coming out of Tuesday was that Trump was an unstoppable force. And that panicked everyone. And then a lot of crazy things happened. We're going to talk about all the crazy things that happened during the week after we talk about the results. But then on Saturday, we had another set, obviously, of primaries. And Trump won Kentucky and Louisiana. And Cruz won Kansas and Maine. Rubio, by the way, got third everywhere except for Maine, where he got fourth behind Kasich. So the big story coming out of this week is that Rubio appears to be dead in the water. That Cruz is sort of on the rise and really the great white hope of the Republican Party to overcome Trump, which is crazy because he's probably the only person they dislike more than Trump. And that Trump is continuing his reign.
Right. That has been my favorite story of the entire week, actually. And it has been a juicy week. And I feel like haven't even actually gotten to a lot of what's amazing, because that is all what happened on the Republican side between Tuesday and Saturday, basically. But my favorite thing to come of this entire week is the fact that it really looks like the main challenger that is going to emerge against Donald Trump is Ted Cruz. Yes. And you're going to have to see the establishment Republicans, and they're already starting to do it. Even Lindsey Graham, who was basically at what, like, not but a month ago, said that picking between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump was like being drowned or taking a bullet to the head or something. That's not right, but he basically like mentioned two ways of dying. Mm-hmm. And like, and just today on Meet the Press, he was like, "Well, we might have to support Ted Cruz."
Yeah, no,
which is good because they hate him just as much, if not more, than Trump. I think they could probably control Trump if it came to
it. I think that they are right to think that Trump would be easier to control than Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is a lone wolf ideological purist. He is somebody who I think I heard some senator, former senator, said that if Ted Cruz was like dying on the floor of the Senate, he'd be the one guy no one would go to help. I mean, he is not only not liked by, you know, people that have to work, you know, like any person that's in favor of Obamacare, but he's not liked by a single person. He does not have one friend in the Senate. Donald Trump is not wrong about that. Cruz is impossible to work with. He's an asshole. So to watch them all sort of twist themselves into pretzels trying to compliment Cruz is going to be real rich. Also, though,
it's so
Cruz
good.
Has been talking like he's some sort of libertarian hero, which is confusing to me, because there's nothing like an ideological purist who doesn't believe in anyone's right to do anything except shoot anyone who's black in the head to be talking about how libertarians should be voting for him. I mean, I'm like so confused about where that's coming from.
Yeah.
Kasich, by the way, got second in Vermont on Tuesday, third in Maine yesterday, but finished ahead of Rubio there and is not going to drop out. So Kasich is there to play. Now, Carson had a hilarious week.
Oh, God.
After Super Tuesday, he makes a vague statement about how he sees no path forward, but he doesn't actually suspend his campaign. He voluntarily withdraws from the next debate, the Thursday debate, but he didn't suspend his campaign. So for like a few days, he and America weren't sure whether he was running for president anymore. Right. And then
what I would like to ask Ben Carson, just personally, is what path he saw forward prior to Super Tuesday.
I know. Like,
because I really want to know about this path.
No.
Because it would have to be...
It's a path that no one else has seen. So it would be a unique path.
He would have to have been riding along this path on a fucking unicorn. Because that path never existed.
No. It didn't exist from the moment that he was polling highest in the race to write. I mean, like, there's not been a single time that it has existed, even when he was winning.
I know.
If everyone had voted the day that he was winning those, you know, in the month that he was ahead of the polls, he still would not have won. That's how much he didn't have a path. But so finally, he makes the announcement that he's dropping out at CPAC on Friday. And now he's sort of semi-starting like a pack that's like a faith group that he's the spokesman for. So that's going in a predictable direction.
Right.
Here are some other things of note, because this week had it all. First of all,
yep.
Trump is now holding victory press conferences instead of rallies.
So
possibly
good.
Because
he had like, his personal prisoner, Chris Christie, stand behind him
on
Tuesday.
There was a meme on Tuesday that you might have noticed, which was pictures of Chris Christie looking like he'd been kidnapped, standing behind Donald Trump at the victory press conference, listening to him spout absolute nonsense for like an hour and not being able to move. And it was like, he literally was like standing frozen and sometimes his eyes would dart back and forth. And like, other times he would attempt to smile. It sort of looked like he had Stockholm Syndrome too. But like, there was like a free Chris Christie hashtag that was going around.
So good.
And Trump had another press conference after winning on Saturday, possibly because he had this rally in Florida right before that where some Black Lives Matter protesters were present. And like, the mob basically turned like full racist mob on them and like dragged them out in a super aggressive manner, and it was like a really gross TV visual that every station played ad nauseum for the entire evening. So I think that he finally has realized that press conferences give him a little more control over the crowd.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say something.
I also think I think that he thinks it makes him seem more presidential. I think it makes him seem just as ridiculous.
It makes him seem silly. But I'm going to say something controversial that I know we're not supposed to say, but here we are saying things sometimes that we're not supposed to say. We do it from time to time.
What are you going to do?
These Trump press conferences are great television.
Oh, my God.
I said it.
You know what I heard? I'm totally with you. I heard an interesting take on these, actually, where someone was I was listening to NPR, and someone was talking about like how, you know, everybody talks about like how this is just sort of like a reality show that he is basically putting on right now because that's what he knows, and that these press conferences that he was having reminded them very much of like when something happens, then you see like the sit down like diary room interview of someone then sort of like re-explaining what has just happened.
Yes.
Like, and that is exactly what it seems like, because all he does at these interviews is like tell you all the places that he's won and tell you all the places that he's going to win and tell you all of the, you know, like he doesn't, There's nothing in them other than him just sort of like retelling you what his, he's just like recapping it reality show, like diary room interview style.
And then he's taking questions from the press after saying that the press are worthless repeatedly that are hilarious every time and get boos from his supporters and things. Like the crowd, even at the press conferences, gets rowdy, which is also hilarious to watch. I mean, the whole thing has been brilliant television. It looks like we're doing a spoof on Donald Trump running for president. It's like, he's spoofing himself. And I know that he's been doing that this whole time, but it's been riveting.
And I was joking with you on Tuesday because they kept talking about this press conference and they kept saying that he had a surprise at the press conference. And I don't know if that was having a prisoner of Chris Christie or what, but like beyond that, I didn't really see like an actual surprise. And I remember texting you that night and I was like, is he just going to drop out? Like, is he just going to be like, you know what, guys?
I was
like, this was all fun while it lasted, but I mean,
but surprise,
I didn't
I'm
really
done.
Think this was going to be happening. Like,
also, I don't want to be president. I already have
I keep
enough
waiting
hair
for that
issues,
moment to happen.
And you know that presidents go gray real fast, so I can't imagine the hair situation that would emerge if Donald Trump actually had to be the president. I mean,
I know, right?
That could be chaos. He already looks like he has a weird cotton candy cloud on his head. Like,
totally.
I don't. I don't know what happens in that situation.
I know. My favorite moment from both of those press conferences, well, besides Chris Christie, but what last night he said, congratulated Ted Cruz on his win in Maine. And he was like, Ted should do well in Maine because it's so close to Canada.
That was brilliant.
Which was so good.
It was so good.
He really knows what he's doing, that guy.
You know,
I mean,
he knows everything.
He might, right, exactly. He might be Hitler, but I mean...
Right. A comment that hasn't been lost on most of the Republican electorate these days. We're going to talk about that in a second. But first, we're going to talk about everything that happened between Tuesday and Saturday. Because there's more.
This is where it gets good.
This is where it gets good. So CPAC was happening, first of all. That's always good. I mean, it's terrible, but good.
Right.
Mitt Romney was brought in to deliver this very high-profile speech about how they should all attack Trump. About they should all be against Trump. He called him a fraud. He called him a phony. He said he would drive the country to the point of collapse. I don't know why we thought we should care about what Mitt Romney thinks, because certainly the American people haven't cared about that up until now. But
well, and that's the whole thing with this. And I get why, you know, he was the nominee from the last election. He was a governor. He is a well-respected person. But I feel like what a lot of Republicans don't understand is the reason why Donald Trump is doing so well, I mean, in large part, is because he sort of swooped in as a person who is a winner. And while that may sound ridiculous, there is a perception among many Republicans that the party, at least on a national level, is a bunch of losers.
It's not a wrong perception.
And no one represents being a bunch of losers more than Mitt Romney does.
So true.
I mean, a man who was able to snatch defeat from the hands of victory in 2012. And immediately when this speech was done, John McCain hopped on board too. And to most of Trump's supporters, he's no better.
To most of America's supporters, he's no better. I mean, these are two of the loseriest presidential losers out there.
Right. So while Mitt Romney gave a great speech, and a lot of people said that it was sort of like the most, you know, cohesive Trump takedown that anyone has made throughout this campaign, the question is, who gives a flying fuck? And I would say no one.
Yeah, I would, except for party insiders who were present at CPAC, who all thought that they were being brilliant.
Right.
But also, Romney was calling for a brokered convention, which is something that, in this environment, I know they've been talking about it, I cannot think of anything more dangerous in this environment than a brokered convention on the Republican ticket. None of them have act with any degree of civility, even when they're just running in a regular election. Like, I mean, someone's going to end up shot at a brokered convention. That's going to be bananas. And it's going to be the exact brand of brilliant reality television that Donald Trump is already bringing us. I mean, they are going to be down at Trump's reality TV level if they try to broker their convention. So I think that that's a risky proposition.
I agree.
And, you know, Mitt Romney is somebody who, like Marco Rubio and like a lot of the contenders that are left, really can't take Trump's brand of insult either. Trump called him a choke artist and a loser and stuff. And like,
oh yeah, I mean, look at what Donald Trump has done to a lot of the people in this race, and at least most specifically, Jeb Bush.
Exactly.
I mean, literally was able to insult him out of the race.
Yeah. And these are...
And if you think that he wouldn't do the exact same thing to Mitt Romney, but maybe even in a more spectacular way,
right,
then you...
You're mistaken. You're
wrong,
person.
Let's have it, because that also sounds like a television.
It's so true. No, I mean, these are two people that represent this sort of aristocratic wing of the Republican Party. They are fighting for a different Republican Party. That they're scared of their constituents at this point. And I mean, this was talked about a lot in the press following Super Tuesday and Super Saturday. But it is clear that the establishment Republicans are terrified of their own constituents. They have been winking at this sort of racist evangelical wing of the party this entire time, and they have come to play, and they do not know what to do about them now, because they're easy to buy off. They were the whole reason that the Republicans had them in the first place was because they had misled those voters. You know, those voters are by and large, you know, lower middle class white people. They, if anyone benefits from a Bernie Sanders platform, they're certainly among those people. But I mean, so these are voters that are already voting against their own interests. So they have no qualms about voting more against their own interests. They don't even care if they vote for a cohesive platform. They vote for mania. That's what they've been voting for this whole time, is pure mania. And so, like, to act like there's some sort of, you know, moral kind of wing of the party, or that there's a sort of, like, respectable wing of the party that we need to get back to, is, like, so insane. Because those people abandoned them a long time ago. It's only really rich corporatists and very poor white people that are supporting this party at the moment. And that those people do not care about what Mitt Romney has to say.
No.
So
certainly not.
Also, Trump is Trump. What there is something I like about Trump. I feel like I don't want to be as complimentary as I'm being. I called him great television. Now I'm about to say something else. He's really sort of dismantling a lot of the mystique around elections and political funding in an interesting way. You know, he's not afraid to. He jumped out and said that in 2012, Mitt Romney had begged for his endorsement. He said he was, you yes. know, I could have said Mitt dropped to your knees. He would have dropped to his knees. That's a crude way of putting it. But my point is that he is sort of announcing all of the unspoken things that you're not supposed to talk about that actually make the political cycle happen. So he's right. saying, of course I donated money to Democrats. I donated money to everyone because you, and I didn't donate that money to them for nothing. I donated it for right, something exactly. in return. And he's saying, Mitt Romney, who's telling me now that I'm destroying the party, he begged me for my endorsement in 2012. He's not right. really, he's not afraid to go there. And this is not something, normally right. you wouldn't say this because it would ruin your political sort of standing in sort of upcoming months. Trump's not afraid to burn bridges, clearly. But because of that, he's sort of dismantling a lot of the machinery that goes on behind the scenes that makes these, that makes people come out for weird, you know, endorse random people and makes everyone sort of rally behind one candidate that seems to have been chosen by a group of, you know, a small group of CEOs. And like all of the things that appear to be happening, he's sort of like making public and explicit what they actually are, which is interesting to right. watch.
Yeah.
I mean, he's also a problem in his own right. So don't take what I just time. Said as an endorsement in any way. But
yeah.
But everyone's panicking. A bunch of senior Republican officials tried to write a letter this week. I don't know who. They're all trying to write letters to
people. Come like, on.
This is not. But it's not leaders that are the problem here. They were writing letters to conservative national security leaders. The leaders are not the issue here. This is the people rebelling against the leaders. You can't, there's no leader to write a letter to tell their flock to not vote for Donald Trump. Those leaders don't exist.
Right.
So in any case,
they really don't.
That's not a type of strategy that they can bother pursuing, but they, you know, they're panicking. So what are they going to do?
Yeah.
In any case, there are some winner take all primaries coming up where, Trump appears like he could sort of galvanize his people further. I think Michigan, Florida, and Ohio are all winner yeah. take all.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, there has been a lot of talk about whether, you know, the sort of trying to take Trump down came too late. I think a lot of people obviously misjudged how popular he was going to be. But, you know, even Romney, who came out this week and said all the things that we just told you he said, is not endorsing anyone, and said something to the effect of, oh, I think like on March 16th will be the time to endorse, which could be the time when there's no one left but Trump
to endorse
that close to the nomination.
Yeah.
So I think they're coming to, they don't have a great plan to take Trump down. I think we learned this week.
Right.
They didn't have any until this week. And even the one that is happening now seems to be sort of hastily thrown together because I still don't think they really know what they're supposed to do. They don't want to support Cruz. I think they would like to support Rubio, but he has been doing so terribly that there are a lot of people, even within his own party, who are saying that he should pull out of the race. He's got Florida coming up that he's probably going to lose. You know, there isn't a cohesive plan to be able to do this other than maybe some sort of, you know, power grab at the convention, which just seems like a losing proposition for the entire party to the point where it could literally split them up in half.
Well, and as, I mean, what's their plan after they try to stop him on the first ballot? Then right. who's on the second ballot? Who are they all voting for?
Right, because who's Mitt Romney in? Says that he doesn't want to be it, and all the Trump people are going to be pissed if it's either of the people who he has beat
yeah.
that are in second or third place behind him in the delegate count. People have thrown out the name Paul Ryan, which, like, since when is he the party savior?
Also,
that little twit? Like, that's the plan now?
Didn't he also Because
he had to come in and
2012?
Save the day and be the Speaker of House.
Right, yeah, like, I know. It's like nobody can do anything. Nobody can fix anything anymore in the Republican Party. Except Paul Ryan, a person who also lost the presidency in 2012.
Yeah.
So, I don't know why yeah. we're all... And also, do not think that a guy who would take those dumb workout photos is your saving grace.
Like, that's not it.
He's no. exercised bad judgment in the past, and we can prove
yeah.
it. There's photos to prove
and
it.
What I would like to mention here, and while I think that in a one-to-one matchup, the polls have showed this before, that Bernie would beat any of those people who are on the GOP side, but if you have concern that he won't, then if you look at what the Republicans' plan is, either at the convention or to end up with a nominee that half of the party is not going to support, then, like, you don't need to worry about whether Bernie Sanders is going to win a general election or not. This is like our best, clearest hope to get this done, guys.
I know. Yeah, we can.
When you look at what's going on with that GOP primary, like, just let's
sneak someone in there.
Let's make it happen. Yeah. Let's have the 74-year-old socialist be the president. Yeah. He could basically walk into the White House.
Yeah, he could just open the door. Himself. Just walk right in. It's literal chaos. Also, a couple side notes that are funny. The first side note is that one of the things that they've been really hitting Trump hard on is this Trump University business, because this, you know, this fraud case is going to go on in the summer, and that would be a bad time for the election. What has been revealed this week is that Romney and company, and his company, by company I mean Rubio, are both involved in fake for-profit colleges themselves. Rubio, in 2014, wrote to the Department of Education on behalf of Corinthian College, which is a super sketch for-profit college that has been shut down since because of fraud and abuse, saying that the department had placed extreme financial constraints on Corinthian College by restricting the company's timely access to federal financial aid, and he called on them to demonstrate leniency. Now, I want to point out that Corinthian College and a lot of these colleges are among the most expensive in the nation, and for the most part have been found to provide like essentially worthless degrees. But because the costs of them are so high, we end up, like, taxpayers end up covering the cost of all of the, like, defaulted loans that we grant for financial aid to these places because they're so expensive and they don't provide any value to the people that go to them. But Rubio has received $27,000 from Corinthian College between 2010 and 2015. So he is being supported by one type of super sketch fake universe, for-profit university. Romney, meanwhile, is not only involved in the University of Phoenix, but he's especially involved in Full Sail University, which is a Florida school. I think it's a film school or something, which he has said knows how to, quote, hold down the cost of their education. Because when you asked him about his education policy, he would talk about these for-profit colleges as a way to keep the cost of education down. He apparently just means down for the taxpayer, but even in the case of the taxpayer, it doesn't work out because Full Sail is actually the third most expensive college in America, and it turns out that their owners, which is a private equity firm, are among Romney's top donors, and that they own other for-profit colleges as well. The thing is, as Romney was endorsing this idea, he never mentioned that he was being extensively supported by an equity firm that owned a whole bunch of for-profit colleges, all of which are among the most expensive in the nation. So.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, and the other thing that I think is...
And they're also under investigation for fraud at Full Sail, by the way. I mean, they're all under fraud investigations.
Well, and also in regards to Romney, too, I think the other problem that he has as being the person who is going to take down Trump is that, you know, as Trump mentioned, he endorsed Romney in 2012, and Romney loved having that endorsement. And in his endorsement, they played this for Romney on Meet the Press, who was being interviewed, talked about how great and wonderful a business person Donald Trump was. Because at the time, you know, he sort of didn't want to really take Donald Trump's endorsement for what it was worth, which was to get the birther movement behind him at the time. But so he talked about how great of a business person he was. And in this speech that he gave this week, talked about how terrible of a business person Donald Trump was and talked about, you know, Trump Magazine and Trump Airlines and Trump Steak and all of these, like, failed businesses that he had. But in 2012, all he could talk about, like, as he went around the entire country with Donald Trump, was how great and wonderful of a businessman Donald Trump was. So it also just looks, you know, pretty disingenuous for him to be going around talking about how Donald Trump isn't a good businessman because he, you know, we're only 4 years away from him saying the exact opposite.
Totally. Second side note. Everyone has been calling Trump comparing Trump to Hitler this week. Louis C.K. wrote a sort of infamous anti-Trump letter that was about Trump being Hitler, but the GOP has been doing it as well. And my dad made a sort of genius point that's related to what we're talking about, but a sort of side note that I just wanted to mention, which is that the GOP has been comparing everyone under the sun to Hitler for so long that they finally want to use this Hitler comparison, and it has no value. It is making no impact. They called Obama Hitler. I mean, they've called everyone Hitler. They've compared Hillary Clinton to Hitler. They compare everyone to Hitler all the time. So now we finally have a really apt Hitler comparison. Trump is running on a fascist platform that has a lot of similarities to the platform that Hitler was running on when he was elected by the people of Germany who actually voted for Adolf Hitler, if we remember that. And Trump even had like a weird moment at his rally where he made them like do a Nazi salute, basically.
How creepy was that?
Oh my God. That whole rally was fucking bonkers, creepy as all get out. But they've sort of they've basically like used up their Hitler capital, because now that we compare everyone to Hitler, the comparison has no value, and there's no other figure like Hitler. I mean, like, you can't compare him to like Mussolini. Like, Mussolini didn't cause the Holocaust. He was just like an idiot fascist dictator who, he's remembered for making the trains run on time and being kind of an asshole. Like, there's no one else to compare him to. So, they shot their whole wad on that. So, in any case, that's a side note that had nothing to do with anything. There is finally a PAC that is starting to drop money on anti-Trump ads. They dropped some in Iowa and New Florida, Hampshire, but in Florida is where they've been focusing of late. I couldn't substantiate any of that, by the way. I heard it on MSNBC repeatedly on Saturday. Could not find a mention of this PAC called Our Priorities anywhere. So sorry for the exciting headline, but we don't have any actual information about them because there's no news about them.
Right.
In any case, some more news.
Another thing that happened this week was Trump was supposed to be speaking to CPAC and pulled out. This was supposed to be on Friday, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. He was supposed to speak. Yeah. And so he pulled out of his speech at CPAC. And this was after sort of the, the week-long throwing him under the bus
CPAC parade was happening
at CPAC. Right. So he just decided not to go, claimed that he was going because he wanted to go to Kansas and campaign instead, which is a ridiculous reason. But also, interestingly, Rubio had gone there after CPAC too, although he did speak at CPAC. And because supposedly, I was hearing on MSNBC that he went to Kansas because he'd done okay in some of the caucuses, and like their internal polling was showing that he was doing well there, and he got third by like a country mile. And Trump actually got second. So they both went to Kansas after CPAC, or in favor of CPAC, and then both lost terribly to Ted Cruz. So whatever.
Classic. Also, Trump released his healthcare plan this week. It didn't have any. Yes. It didn't have any planning in it.
Air quotes.
He released a document that talked about healthcare this week.
Yeah, it had. He released bullet points.
It had some bullet points. You cannot argue with facts, Brent, and that is a fact. There were bullet points.
And it's a little disappointing. Not as if I necessarily expected anything else. Although, healthcare is one of the things that Donald Trump a few times has accidentally stumbled upon a good idea for. This is happening a lot in debates with him and in some of his speeches where I don't really think that he knows what he's talking about, or he's talking about beliefs that he used to have and hasn't realized that he's not supposed to have them anymore.
He's sort of talking about incomplete ideas that he doesn't follow through to their practical extreme.
And healthcare is one of those things where he has sort of like accidentally almost sounded like he was talking about single payer or, what have you. But the bullet plans, not that.
They were not that. It was the sort they of were, typical. I mean, I'm going to continue to point out that he has the most complete health reform policy of any of the Republicans, because the rest of them are just in favor of repealing Obamacare and have yet to mention anything past that plan.
Right, exactly.
Some of them talk about using health savings accounts, HSAs. We all know that those are a bunch of bullshit. Donald Trump in the bullet points talks about letting people buy their own health insurance and deduct the premiums from their income taxes. But that's all well and good unless you don't make enough money to even pay for income taxes. Because if you can't deduct $2,000 from your income taxes because you don't have $2,000 in taxes
to pay. Well, and you still have to pay for it. That's what I was going to say. You still have to pay it. And taxes aside, whether you're taking off your taxes at the end of the year, you still have to be able to pay for it on a monthly basis.
Exactly.
And there are obviously people, and especially people who, because he wants to get rid of the, being able to get on a plan if you have pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. These people are people who don't have, an extra $200 that they can pay 1 month, let alone 12 months, and then deal with it.
Yes, he specifically said at the debate that he would not get rid of the pre-existing condition coverage. So that was an interesting reversal.
Yeah.
One of his this accidental.
From a man who has talked a lot about not wanting to let people die on the street.
There's no plan to stop that.
He's back in favor of wanting to let people die on the street.
So it's good to know where he stands finally, because it's been a roller coaster. It's not a complete proposal. It's only a few pages long. It's more complete than what everyone else has proposed, but that is a breathtakingly slim, criteria to me. That's that doesn't really mean anything at all because the rest of them haven't proposed anything at all. The only place where he really breaks with the party is that he does talk about wanting Congress to stand up to drug companies. He talks about importing drugs from other countries so that they're not so expensive, and he doesn't think that market competition in the drug pharmaceutical world is enough. So right. That's really the only idea that was worth a damn in that proposal, yeah. But still a man, back to being a man in favor of people dying in the streets. So
correct.
There's that.
Yes.
And now, one hour into our podcast, we finally get to the headliner, which is,
oh man,
Thursday's GOP debate in Detroit was fucking bonkers. The Times, first of all, did a TV review of it as if it was an episode of television with the headline, "A National Descent into Trump's Pants."
And I want to continue to descend into Trump's pants as many times as we can as a country, because that was
good television, guys.
So good. That was good television. Now, it was not good television if you were tuning in for a presidential debate.
No.
I was talking to my mother, who watched it before I did, because I had to watch it later in the evening, and she was like, we watched long enough to get to the portion where we started talking about Donald Trump's, you know, penis, right. Which was fairly early in the debate, and they're like, we're out. And of course, I got to that moment, and I was like, where's the popcorn? Right.
the way that the Times review described it was pretty great, so I'm just going to read that. It says, gobsmacking day of intra-party pie-throwing ended with Donald J. Trump from the stage of the Fox Theater in Detroit assuring the American public that the size of his male appendage was just fine. I guarantee you, he said, there's no problem. And what's crazy is that his comments weren't even unprompted. As part of Rubio's insult comedy tour of America, he's been joking about this hilarious thing that is the size of Trump's hands, which is something that Trump is really touchy about. And so Rubio has been saying, you know what they say about men with small hands. So on the debate stage, Trump stretched his hands out for the audience to see and then insisted that the suggestion that something else must be small was false. For those of you who don't know the story of Trump's hands, it's epic. It has to do with Graydon Carter, who, he's with Vanity Fair now, but at 25 years ago, he was working at Spy magazine, and he took to calling Trump a short-fingered vulgarian. And he recently wrote in Vanity Fair the whole story of his hand size feud with Trump, because Trump took great offense to this. He said in Vanity Fair, "To this day, I receive the occasional envelope from Trump. There is always a photo of him, generally a tear sheet from a magazine. On all of them, he has circled his hand in gold Sharpie in a valiant effort to highlight the length of his fingers. I almost feel sorry for the poor fellow, because to me, the fingers still look abnormally stubby. The most recent offering arrived earlier this year, before his decision to get into the presidential, to go after the presidential nomination. Like the other packages, this one included a circle hand and the words, also written in gold Sharpie, 'See, not so short.' I sent the picture back by return mail with a note attached saying, 'Actually, quite short,' which I can only assume gave him fits." So that's a real thing that's going on.
Good.
Also, P.S., confirmed from the many Trump press conferences I watched this week, he's a man with short, stubby fingers. That can't be denied.
He has
stubby fingers. That's a real-life fact about Donald Trump. You know,
yeah.
Marco Rubio has big ears. He has stubby fingers. We all have things we can... Ted Cruz looks like Beelzebub. So, I mean, we all have things we don't like about ourselves. And that's, you know, those are the things that you can't argue with people's eyes. You know, you just can't.
You really can't.
And anyway, back to the debate. Nobody could get Trump to talk about any actual issues. Nobody wanted to talk about actual issues. So let's not even bother talking about the actual issues because they had nothing to do with anything. Here are some highlights. First of all, Trump started calling Rubio Little Marco.
So good.
Is the greatest.
And he's continued that all week. He's really riding that.
He is riding it. And I think at one point, Rubio started calling him Big Donald, which sounded made Trump sound cooler than he already sounded for calling him Little Marco. I mean, everything went predictably after that. There was a lot of talk about Trump University. Nobody has the right to question him because, as we now know, they're all involved in fake for-profit colleges, but they are obsessed with this case. Trump was put on the defensive a few times because he had evidently said to the New York Times that he was sort of flexible on his immigration policy in an off-the-record conversation.
And
he's also, he contradicts himself constantly, so there were a million reasons why he could be on the defensive.
Yeah, well, and that flexible thing came up in the debate, too, in probably the second best moment of the evening. Because Donald Trump was, like, getting really worked up about something. Oh, they were talking about the Supreme Court nomination, and Ted Cruz said to Donald, like, breathe, Donald. I know it's hard, but take a breath, and, like, kept going through this whole thing. And Rubio interjected and said, when they're done with the yoga, can I answer the question? And Cruz said, you cannot. I really hope that we don't see any yoga on the stage. And Rubio said, well, he's very flexible, so you never know. But, like, between the three of them doing this,
the Marx,
like,
brothers.
It went, like, bing, bang, but yes, exactly. No, it was. It absolutely was, like, a fucking comedy routine. Like, in a way that was just, like, so perfect that it couldn't even... It was hard to believe that it was happening, which was why it was so good.
Also, since we are in the schoolyard anyway, Ted Cruz also appeared to eat a booger at the debate.
No, it was hanging out of his mouth at one point. And there's video. Well, there's obviously a video because it was on the debate. But, like, you can... If you think that we're making this up and we're just being childish, then it exists.
It's really disgusting. So that's the state that we're at right now.
Yeah.
Also, there's
the one thing that I will say about, oh, sorry, before we go, I want to say one more thing about the Republican debate, and that is, and it may be too late for anyone to care, but it was what I found also sort of interesting about this debate was, since there was a fourth person there, and you haven't heard us say anything about him yet.
There was barely a fourth person there.
But, and like I said, it may be too late, but, like, he had a lot of good moments, and they were all moments where he made it specific to everyone that he was going to stay out of the fray. Yeah. It was the first debate where there were only the four of them because Ben Carson didn't go to it. And there was one of the biggest applause lines of the night was where they asked him and asked John Kasich a question, and I don't even remember what it was, but it was obviously intended to get him to sort of, like, start the mudslinging. And he said, I see what you're doing, and I'm not taking the bait. And the room totally erupted. It's going to be interesting to see whether he can sort of make any hay of this. I don't know how many more debates there are left.
I feel like he's got the O'Malley curse on him. You know how O'Malley won all of those Democratic debates, and it didn't matter at all?
If Martin O'Malley wins a debate, does anyone hear it happen?
If a tree falls?
Yeah, exactly.
That's. I feel like that's what was sort of going on with him, because the only way to get headlines is to get into the fray. And
totally.
The only way for anyone to know your name is to be in the headlines. And so it's almost like you forget that he's running in this race at all. And it's because he's making sense and being an adult.
Well, and I know I said that last point that I made was the last point about the debate, but I want to make one
more.
Go
for it.
And this point is not necessarily mine. I heard, I can't remember who said this, but I thought it was really fascinating, because the last thing that happened at the debate, and this sort of harkened back to the first debate, where they talked about whether everyone would support whoever the nominee was, or if, you know, if you're Donald Trump, will you say that you won't run as a third-party candidate? And so they asked all of them, and they came to John Kasich last, if they would all support Trump. And this was after an entire week of everyone, you know, going down the anyone but Trump route. And they all said that they would support him, and I think that was an error in all of their judgments, but specifically John Kasich, who was way behind, and they came to him third. He could have been the one person to have that. He could have been the new anybody but Trump person had he just said, I'm not going to support him. He would have been in the headlines the next day.
Yep.
Like, there would have been his headline-making moment, and he could have probably gotten a lot of people to sort of coalesce around him. And, you know, maybe even move that into winning Ohio and being a reasonable candidate. And I think it was a really poor lapse of judgment for him to not see that opening. Like, it was a bad debate move. Like, if Ted Cruz, if he was the third person
would have
to
known
be asked,
the answer,
would have known what he was supposed to do.
Yeah. No, that's...
So...
Well, John Kasich,
anyway,
trying to be an adult, failing at being a presidential candidate.
Failing at winning. Yeah, exactly.
Meanwhile... Some quick stories before we go. First of all, along the lines of the Ted Cruz eating a booger moment.
Booger eating.
Mm-hmm. I haven't said the word booger in years, too. There's just no other way to describe what he was doing.
No. No, he ate a booger.
Marco Rubio snuck a pill at a rally, and so a bunch of conspiracy people on the internet are convinced he's using speed. He's popping what could be a breath mint, but it could be an illegal drug, Brent. You don't know. And at the debate, according to YouTube, according to a YouTube video, I mean, at a rally, according to a YouTube video, conspiracy theorists are assuming that obviously he needs to be drug tested.
Well, let's do it. We're drug testing people who are
on welfare. Yeah, we might as well drug test presidential candidates.
Bingo.
Exactly. Right. Also, there's been a slew of articles, and I only pulled one, but there have been a bunch of these about how there are a bunch of people are being driven into therapy by Trump. Where people's anxiety about Trump or about the fact that their family is supporting Trump have been driving people to therapy. This article that I pulled was from the West Side Rag. It's about people on the Upper West Side in New York going to therapy because either they're anxious about what Trump means for America or they're anxious because their family members are supporting Trump and they can't understand what's going on. So you can imagine this is a problem, especially in New York, where people know how insane Trump is and really like are having a hard time grasping why anyone is buying this. But right. These articles have been coming out here and there all over the country. So that's something to think about.
Yeah.
And in a final note, Ray Tomlinson, who invented email, died.
Yeah.
Among the people who died, he invented the at sign, too.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Well, he invented using it.
Right. He invented, yeah.
Because it was on the keyboard, but it was rarely used, and it was the only preposition, which I found interesting. So that's why I used it. Because it's the only key that's like an actual, it's a word, that key.
That's right.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, so that's some history of internet for you.
So there you go. That we probably totally got wrong.
Yeah. Well,
I might have just made any of those things that I set up.
We're not internet scholars, guys.
No.
We are political scholars. We don't care about computers. We're having a hard time figuring. We had a hard time figuring out how to use them tonight.
Yeah, we didn't know if we were supposed to Skype each other or how I could get FaceTime on my computer. It was a real debacle, but we figured it out. We certainly don't know anything about the at sign.
No, and let's not try. So that's the news this week. We'll be back next week on the same coast, where we will bring you a better sound quality version of the events of next week, which should be just as exciting as the events of this week, because Michigan's voting on Tuesday.
Bingo. That's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
So we will talk to you then.
Bye.
Bye.